Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you guys doing? Today we're going to be going through the arguments, the adapted arguments that I've put forward, alhamdulillah, when I was doing my dissertation. And so this has obviously been looked at by, reviewed by my professor when I was at the University of Oxford, doing the work. Recently, as you guys know, I finished it and I got some good feedback from him, to be fair to him. We've done really well. And these are my proofs. I tried to keep it concise and, you know, adapt it based on what we've just talked about, not just Ibn Sina's argument, but also the kind of recommendations of the medieval scholars that came and added or subtracted or whatever it is from his argument. So the first slide is the main proposition. Okay, this is what we are claiming. And in many ways, this is the entire argument in one sentence. We are claiming this. There cannot be a world with only dependent things without reference to an independent thing, as dependent things cannot continue existing on their own. Existence is only explicable with reference to an independent existence, as impossible existences do not exist by logical necessity. Furthermore, dependent existence cannot self-generate or self-maintain. Okay, so if the person agrees with this proposition, then they have agreed with us. So it's fine. You're right. There can't be a world with only dependent things, because dependent things can, because dependent things by themselves are self-generatable, if you like, are not self-generatable, and they're not self-maintaining. There can't be a world with only things which are susceptible to being destroyed, and that cannot be maintained by themselves. There cannot be such a world. If they say, yes, you're right, say, fine. So you agree there must be an independent thing. Well, all things depend upon it, and it depends upon nothing. Say, fine. That's now we've reached agreement. We'd move on to the second part, which is, why is it one, etc. That's fine. If they say, no, you're wrong, actually. If they say you're wrong about this, there can be such a world where there are, imagine now, reading this again, instead of saying there cannot be, let's just read it the other way. There can be a world. They're saying, actually, we disagree with you. And we say, there can be a world with only dependent things without reference to an independent thing. As dependent things, now we're saying, can exist or continue existence on their existing on their own. Existence is only explicable with reference. It's not only explicable with reference to an independent thing. They'll say, as impossible existences, they'll agree with us, do not exist by logical necessity. Furthermore, dependent existence can self-generate or self-maintain. So if they disagree with us on every point, then actually they've agreed with us. Why is that the case? Because they say, okay, well, if dependent things can self-generate or self-maintain, then what are they? Then they're independent and necessary. Now, if there's a series of things which can self-generate or self-maintain, and you're saying the series of things, the infinite multiverse can, whatever it may be, can self-generate or self-maintain, you are saying the infinite multiverse is what? Dependent or independent? Independent. Therefore, there, you are saying that you do believe in an independent thing. However, we would say, so we talked about this, we'd argue from composition, ad absurdum, that something which is made up of pieces cannot be independent because it's dependent on those pieces. So how do we say that? We'll look at proof one underneath. Everything made up of pieces is dependent, we would say. The universe is made up of pieces, therefore the universe is dependent. Now you can say this about the multiverse, an infinite multiverse. Anything made up of pieces is dependent. The infinite multiverse is made up of pieces, therefore the infinite multiverse is dependent. Now they say, okay, well, that's the composition fallacy or whatever, yeah? So no problem. We can make this argument even on a mathematical basis. Any set with more than one member is dependent on its members. A member of a set is the part of the set, or an infinite set has more than one member. Therefore, an infinite set is dependent on its members. So you can make this argument ontologically. Any questions on this? No comments. With the initial proposition made, and the argument, therefore, if they say it's an infinite multiverse. Yeah.
Just to, So when we talk about the universe, you said this, I guess making this argument, say that the universe is made up of pieces, that can fall to the composition fallacy, right? But is there any way to talk about the universe as a whole where you don't fall into that fallacy? Because I feel like there might be a difference between saying, for example, that, I don't know, it's not exactly the same as saying this laptop is made up of pieces, therefore the laptop is dependent. You said the universe is made up of pieces, therefore the universe is dependent.
The thing is with the compositional fallacy is this. The atheist and the theist both don't know how to speak about the whole because they don't encompass the whole. So when we talk about the compositional fallacy, we say something like, if I say the pieces of an elephant are small, therefore the elephant is small, I'm making a compositional fallacy because I'm generalizing the part to a whole with a generalization which is disparate, where the part does not match the whole. However, it's not always the case that the part doesn't match the whole, because as I've mentioned before, you can have a red wall made up of red bricks, and the red bricks are not disparate, in fact, are commensurate with the red wall. Okay? So the only way you can call it a fallacy is if you know the whole is disparate from the part. Now, the atheist doesn't know that the whole is disparate from the part.
But if they agree with you that the universe is made up out of pieces, then they've agreed with you that the universe is dependent.
No, but the issue with making the argument only cosmologically is they'll say, well, you're saying, how do you know that the universe is made up of pieces? You only know that the universe is made up of pieces because you're observing pieces in the universe being dependent on other things. So it's an inductive thing. If you have an ontological aspect of this and say, well, actually, this is even the case in the mind. This is the case even conceptually, right? Then you'll say, from all perspectives, therefore, it's not just cosmological, but it's from all perspectives that you can envisage, whenever something is made up of something, that thing is dependent on it. A triangle is made up of three sides. A triangle has no place in the real world. A triangle cannot be smelt, cannot be touched, cannot be licked and tasted, and so on. The empirical reality does not apply to a triangle. But we know that the triangle, in order for its triangularity to be established, there must be three straight lines, all equating, if we want to be mathematical, by 180 degrees. So a triangle depends on three straight lines. And that's a fact. Without it, you have something else. You have another shape, you know. So you can ontologically argue that some things depend on things even without reference to the cosmos. And if you make this argument on two separate tracks, which is what I'm proposing here, then what we're saying is it's not just a physical property, it's a metaphysical property as well, which can be established through set theory, it can be established through mathematics, it can even be established through geometry. So why are we assuming that something which can be established cosmologically, geometrically, mathematically, and logically does not apply to the universe? It's much stronger than saying, why is it something that within the universe, what happened to it? I think if you corner it off from all those perspectives, you're creating different tracks. And Ibn Tufayl made this point, actually. He said, when you're making arguments for God's existence, it's like when you're playing chess. He said, you have to argue from different tracks. When you're playing chess, you don't only have one line of the attack. You try and get two pieces. I'm not a chess player, but I can imagine. In martial arts, the same thing. You don't just start throwing haymakers. You have to set it up. You know, you got the left, you got the jab, then the right hand, then the left hook. You have to set it all up. So if you try and come with one line of attack, it's usually, but even if you're a specialist, like what I'm saying is, to be a specialist, you should have two lines of attack. Because it makes the argumentative target for them so big. That it's like, you know, you've just presented them with a huge wall that they have to just bring a machine gun, just keep shooting it, try and get rid of it. It's huge. It's like a boulder coming at them. Now what you have to do, deny everything. Deny logic, deny maths, deny all the entailments of logic, the entailments of maths, the entailments of geometry, and the cosmological reality as well. It's better than just the cosmological reality, especially with reference to the quantum world as well. Which has thrown a spanner, the cat in with the pigeons, actually, which we don't know anything about quantum, and we don't know how to put together quantum physics with the macro world. There is no all-encompassing theory; it doesn't exist. So, you know, and by the way, with quantum physics, they start with different axioms. Some even start with retrocausality. I've seen this in papers. They start with retrocausality as an axiom. You know, the effect comes before the cause and all this kind of stuff. What are you going to do with that? So, if you start going into the scientific and the cosmological reality and only depend upon it, then just by virtue of the fact that quantum physics is becoming something which is an uncontrollable animal, much like many of my opponents. no, I'm joking. Okay. But you know, it's going to be hard to, you know, argue for it in that way. I think you should have separate lines. Yeah. So that's why that's the that is the reasoning for having a cosmological aspect and an ontological aspect. It heightens and it strengthens the timeless feature. So the second proof. Existence is presupposed in everything that is real. Necessary facts are real, therefore necessary facts are presupposed existence. And this just establishes the first part of Ibn Sina's, there is no doubt that there is existence. That's the most foundational thing you can ever think about. Existence is the most foundational thing. Now, the category of existence has to be the most foundational thing, because we said 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a necessary fact. It cannot be conceived of in any other way. But you can't say 2 plus 2 equals 4 brought about everything that exists, because 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a necessary fact, it's not a necessary existence. And the category of existence is presupposed, or the category of fact is presupposed in the category of existence. Or the category of existence is presupposed in the category of fact. So if existence is the first thing that anything must have in order to be, wujud, which is existence. And what when we're saying in the category of existence, there's one necessary existence. That's the argument. So we need to establish why existences are more foundational than anything else. By the way, modally speaking, there's even that which is referred to as scientific necessity. I'll give you just one example. If I say I can run 100 meters in 2 seconds. Now that is impossible from a scientific perspective. I can't run 100, and I don't think anyone here can do it. Right, no one can run 100 meters in 2 seconds, okay? Not even Usain Bolt, even if you give him drugs, whatever, you know? Not that we don't know if he's already taken them or not, but, you know, no one's going to run 1 second, okay? It's scientifically impossible. So when we talk about impossibilities and possibilities and necessities, the modal categories, these are called modal categories, okay? That's scientific necessity, scientific impossibility, scientific whatever. But we are not talking about that. We are talking about logical necessity. We are talking, and there is a difference between logical necessity and scientific necessities. And logical necessities are much stronger, like, you know, more robust, because they're metaphysical. They don't depend on the physical world. Whereas scientific necessities and so on, and impossibilities, are things which you must reason through induction. So, proof two could say, anything that can be conceivably rearranged abstractly is contingent. The universe can be conceivably rearranged abstractly, therefore the universe is contingent. And this is an ontological reality, just like a set in a set theory, or the members of a set in a set in a set can be arranged in a different way, therefore it's contingent. It can be rearranged. It's contingent. It's not hard like that. It's not unchangeable. And so the universe from that, why did I say abstractly? Because some determinists may say, well, actually everything is necessary because it is predicated on an uninterrupted causal chain or an antecedent cause of events which came before it. And so we are living a cosmic ventriloquism. I am a puppet to all of the uninterrupted causal chain that came before me. I am moving now, not by any will of my own, but because there was an uninterrupted chain, and in fact that bottle was made out of necessity, and this packet was made out of necessity, my phone was there. Everything is necessary from that perspective. So when we say from in abstraction, we're removing without reference to what? The uninterrupted causal chain or the antecedent cause of events, whatever it is. So we're saying that's what we're talking about. This in isolation cannot be necessary, because if it was, it would not have had a beginning in the form that it has, and so on. So that's why I mentioned the word abstractly. Any questions on that point, the second proof?
It's already two, but singularity, particularization?
No, that's going to come. Okay. Third proof. Anything that can be conceived of otherwise in abstraction was arranged by something else. This is particularization. The universe could be conceived of otherwise in abstraction, therefore the universe was arranged by something else. Why? Because there's nothing within it. If it can be conceived of otherwise in abstraction, it doesn't have a quality of necessity that keeps it as it is pre-eternally and post-eternally. So for that reason, it requires that which is outside of it in order to arrange it. It's impossible for something contingent to give itself, you know, the property of necessity, as straightforward as that might sound. So in other words, if something has the potential, and this goes to kind of like the whole actual potential discussion that, you know, we've heard from Aristotle. If something has the potential to be otherwise, then it cannot be necessary. If something has the potential to be otherwise, it cannot be necessary. What's an example of something that has the potential to be otherwise? As we mentioned before, like for example, the egg, the chicken's egg. The chicken's egg, what is it? It's what, inside yolk and this and that. And then it becomes what? A chick. I'm not talking about ladies here. I'm not talking about the ladies. A chick is actual animal. Now, so the egg is a potential. It's in a potential state. And the fact that it's actualizing indicates to us that there's something outside of itself creating change within it. Because it's impossible that it's creating change within itself. Because if it is being created, if it's creating change within itself and it has the capacity to do that, then it would be actual. It wouldn't be potential. And if it's actual, then it's independent. Or at least it's not, if it's purely actual, I should say. You know, it's not contingent. And so this, if it could be another way, it can be rearranged, you can squash it, you can break it, you can smash it, like I do with an egg, then you can't say that this thing is necessary. How could it be necessary? Necessary in what sense? In form? In shape? In composition? Certainly not. Because if it was, it would be an egg that I throw and nothing will happen to it, like a bouncy ball or something. But even then, with a bouncy ball, you can cut it in pieces. Like, you know, something which is necessary cannot be manipulated. Basically, cannot be manipulated. Like 2 plus 2 equals 4, do what you want to it. It's a metaphysical fact that it will stay the same way always. You know. So anything that can be conceived of otherwise in abstraction is contingent. The universe can be conceived of otherwise in abstraction. You can, as Ghazali mentions, you can conceive of a world or a universe where the revolutions of the celestial spheres are the other way. It's not clockwise, it's anti-clockwise, for example. And if that's the case, we've already established that the conceivability factor is there to make this universe a different way. The jacket, this thing I'm wearing, is brown. It could have been black, could have been blue, could have been orange, could have been any other color. And it can still be now. I can change it. So it's not necessary. It's also dependent, you know. So this is the third proof. Any questions on that? No. Number four. The universe is fine-tuned for life by necessity or contingency. Now, the fact that the universe is fine-tuned for life is not controversial at all, because the universe exists and life exists and the constants are fine-tuned for our existence. Okay, that is, I don't know if anyone disagrees with that, even the belligerent new atheists. They agree with that. In fact, Richard Dawkins refers to it as the Goldilocks zone. Everything is in the Goldilocks zone. I'm not talking about, by the way, the electromagnetic constant and the gravitational constant. We know that is within those parameters, but I'm not talking even about that. We spoke about this before. We're talking about stability, regularity, uniformity. The fact that things are uniform and regular and stable. But the universe is fine-tuned for life by necessity or contingency. If it is fine-tuned by necessity, then the necessary existence must account for the necessary fact of fine-tuning. Because we said that existences precede facts. Existence is the most foundational thing, yeah? If it is fine-tuned by contingency, then a necessary existence must account for a series of, for any series of contingencies. The universe is fine-tuned for life, therefore, the universe is fine-tuned for life by necessary existence. Why? Because we've already explained why you need a necessary existence in the proof one. So these four arguments here are not cause-based arguments. You don't need cause for any of those arguments. The word cause is not even in any of those arguments. Because someone will say, I don't believe in causation. Or we haven't even used the word cause. Dependency is something which, we've mentioned this before, we'll mention it again. Something which is dependent is something which relies on something else for its existence. A cause is something which brings rise to phenomena. Now, there's a more technical definition of the term cause, which is mentioned by John Mackey, for example, in his essay on it, where it's, yeah, I'm paraphrasing, but if A isn't there, if B isn't there, and A is the sufficient cause for B, then B wouldn't be there without A, basically, something to that effect. But it's in the dissertation, you can see that, I think I've mentioned it somewhere, that definition. So yes, any questions on the fourth proof? No. The fifth one now. Anything that is made up of pieces is caused. The universe is made up of pieces, therefore the universe is caused. Very straightforward. Obviously, the main thing here is the compositional fallacy. So actually now you're saying that just because it's made up of pieces within the universe, therefore, then we can say the same thing ontologically. We could say causation itself is metaphysical. It's a metaphysical thing. But that would require some level of argumentation. But you can make a cause-based argument. We're not against cause-based arguments. But we're just trying to divert all the objections, to be honest. So if they don't like causation, no problem. We can deal with contingency aside from causation. Because causation and contingency are not... They can be made mutually exclusive. Dependency and causation can be made mutually exclusive. We mentioned this before. I can give birth to a child, or not me, I can give rise to a child, I can cause a child through other actions, you know, and, you know, my wife will give birth to the child, so the child is caused by me, but it doesn't depend on me, because if I die, the child can continue living. I can build a house, the house is caused by me, but if I die, the house can continue being there. So a cause is something which brings rise to phenomena, whereas something which is dependent is something which is reliant on something else for its existence. So causation and dependency can be extracted from one another, or can be made mutually exclusive from one another. So when arguments 1 to 4 are not even cause-based arguments. Argument 5 is a cause-based argument. If you want to use it, you can. If the person is not skeptical, causal skeptic, you know, you can use the argument. If the guy's a causal guy here, I don't believe in causes. Really, you don't believe in causes? If someone says to you, I don't believe in causation, so you don't believe in science then? Because one of the presuppositions of science is causation. Even quantum physics. If you don't believe in causation, if you want to put an axiom, as some of them do, of retrocausation, as we said, it's an axiom usually. Meaning, it's not something they discover from. They don't discover retrocausality from quantum physics. They assume it before they start, in some models. Does that make sense? That's what we mean by axiom. They assume retrocausality before they start, rather than they discover it because of it. But anyway, even if you wanted to do that, you need some level of causation, even if it's retro. You need some kind of causation. Now, if you don't have some kind of causation, especially if you're talking to an atheist who's a Darwinian evolutionist, how on earth are you going to believe in Darwinian evolution without causation? There's no way. What caused what? How did this transformation happen? You know? And obviously we're going to have a session on Darwinism. It's going to be less polemical than you think. Because what? I mean, what do we really disagree with? Like a slither? Or the evolutionary project, what? 0.000 times 100, 1% we disagree. We don't care about this evolution. They think it's some major argument against theism. It's not. It's nothing. But if someone doesn't believe in causation, how can you believe in science? Especially if you're a materialist. It's very embarrassing, actually. So you'd have to highlight that inconsistency. So these are the five proofs that we've got in place. Go on.
Just on that fifth proof, that first premise, anything made up of pieces is caused. Is that based on the fine tuning?
No.
How do we get that first premise?
Everything that you get it inductively.
Right.
You get it inductively. And so this argument by itself is susceptible to the compositional fallacy objection, even though there's going to be a deadlock, as we said, because we can't prove that the situation is that it's red bricks versus red wall, and they can't prove the situation is small pieces, therefore big and big whale. There's a gridlock. So in order to break the gridlock, we have to speak about metaphysics. Therefore, an argument like this should never be made in isolation. Like, these arguments are not good to be made in isolation. If you're speaking academically with someone and you want to avoid all the objections, make the argument ontologically and cosmologically at the same time. That's what I think, anyway.
So what's the reason, because it's inductively found the first premise, like, what's the reason why we say pieces instead of just a universe? Like, it would be the same argument, right?
Say that again, what do you mean?
Like, I mean, what's the purpose of having the proof five and just changing universe to pieces? I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to show here.
Sorry?
Like, in proof five, like, you mentioned anything made up of pieces is caused, but like, we could have easily just said anything which had a beginning is caused, right? Like, it's the same kind of argument.
Same kind of argument.
Yeah.
But no, the only thing is, okay, good. When you why did I not say everything that begins to exist has a cause? The universe began to exist.
It's also inductively
fine, no, because right? The issue is now proving the universe began to exist. You have two layers of problem. Well, if you're trying to prove that the universe began to exist, you have to go and scientifically explain that. This one averts the scientific discussion of trying to prove that the oscillating universe model is false, or Penrose is wrong, or the CRC, whatever it's, I can't remember what it's called, CRT or whatever, the cyclical model is wrong, all those things. We're not even talking about, we would say it jumps straight to a compositional type of argumentation. So this, it diverts, and the point here is you're trying to divert more objection. You want to make a statement that doesn't have refutational susceptibility. Or you want to make as many statements as you can in life that are least prone and susceptible to refutation. Now, that might be impossible in marriage. But it's more possible in these kinds of situations when you think about them. Anything I say in marriage is false. in some cases. I'm only kidding. It's fine. She knows it's true. Now, we've done this before, but we'll do it again. The arguments for oneness. The first argument from oneness goes as follows. Why is it one necessary existence? Why is it not a plethora, a multiplicity of multiple necessary existences altogether? Why is it just one? So we say, if a necessary existence is an existence that cannot be any other way, there cannot be more than one. A necessary existence cannot be any other way. Therefore, there cannot be more than one necessary existence. Why? If you have God 1 and God 2, so-called, yeah? And God 1 is meant to be something that it can't be any other way. But God 2 has a differentiating factor which differentiates it from God 1. That differentiating factor which differentiates it from God 1 indicates that God 2 is contingent because it can be perceived of in another way. And the evidence of that is that it has a so-called differentiating factor. All that both of so-called God 1 and God 2 are both contingent. So you've got two options. Either both of them are contingent, or one of them is contingent. But it's impossible for both of them to be necessary. And that disqualifies the Trinity from being true.
So we could never imagine. You could never imagine in life God 1.
Say that again.
So we could never imagine in life God 1. If you can imagine, then it means
if God 1 is there and God 2 is there, yeah, and God 2 has something which separates himself or herself or itself or whatever self from God 1, yeah, then that differentiating factor indicates that, okay, we said necessary existence is something that cannot be any other way. But if God 2 has a hat on, Pete Adamson gives this example. I'm going to give him credit for it in his discussion of Avicenna. If he's God 2 has a hat on, that hat indicates it's God 2's, he's got a mustache, I think he said, or whatever, you know. This factor of God 2 indicates that it's contingent, because it can be in a void. You can imagine it without a mustache, or a hat, or something. It's a ridiculous example. But any differentiating factor which make it possible for entity 2 or God 2 to be any other way, makes it impossible for that thing that we're talking about to be necessary, because a necessary being is something that cannot be any other way. Just like 2 plus 2 equals 4 cannot be any other 5 or 6 or 3. It's incorrigible.
So like I said, a necessary being, we can never imagine that necessary being physically.
It's not, yeah, we don't even attribute physicality to. In fact, we do the opposite. We attribute incorporeality to the necessary existence. It can't be physical because a physical thing is made up of parts, is made up of dependent things, is contingent and so on, and therefore it's impossible for it to be necessary. You see? Does that make sense? Is there any questions on this? Okay. The second one is, if the necessary existence is responsible for all other things in existence, then the necessary existence has capacity of all other things in existence, over all things in existence. The necessary existence is responsible for all other things in existence. Therefore, the necessary existence has capacity over all things in existence. Continued. Yeah, so this is two parts. If the necessary existence has ultimate capacity of over all things in existence, nothing other than the necessary existence is over all things capable. Because if it's the main thing that's responsible and it has the ultimate, it's the ultimate source through which everything else has its it's the ultimate source of existence for everything contingent, then that means that disqualifies anything contingent by necessity from being the ultimate source of everything that's contingent. This kind of goes back to what we were talking about Ibn Sina, when we said that if there is a set of contingent things, then it's impossible to think that there's a necessary thing within that set, because the set of contingent things describes everything that's contingent. So if that case, if you have something which is the source of all things in existence and it has capacity over them, then the necessary existence has capacity over all things. Therefore, the necessary existence is over all things capable. Is over all things capable. This is what comes up in the Quran all the time. This exact phraseology. Over all things. Actually, I got it from there. Over all things capable. Yes.
But isn't this argument kind of like begging the question? Because in the first premise, like, isn't that exactly what you're trying to prove?
Why? Give me. It's which one?
Because you're basically. Because if a necessary existence is responsible for all other things in existence, isn't this exactly what you're trying to prove, though?
Yeah, but that we don't establish that. Through this argument, we established that through the first argument we make. This is why these arguments have to be put together. So we've already argued that the necessary existence. We're not going to present this by itself. We're going to prove that necessary existence is a necessary existence first, and that it's responsible for whatever. And now we're saying, well, if that's the case, because this is trying to prove oneness. Why there's only one of them?
In the first one, didn't we already prove oneness though?
Yeah, but this is a different line. Now I'm giving you another argument to prove oneness. This draws us inspiration, yeah, from the Quranic verse, and it's called Dalilu Tamanu, the evidence of exclusion. مَتَّخَذَ اللَّهُ مِنْ وَلَدٍ وَمَا كَانَ مَعَهُ مِنْ إِلَهِ إِذَنْ لَذَهَبَ كُلُّ إِلَهٍ بِمَا خَلَقَ وَلَعَلَى بَعْضُهُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ. That God didn't take a son, and he doesn't have any God with him. If that was the case, they would have tried to strip away all of the things that they created, and they would have tried to dominate one another. So in other words, you can't have two all-powerful agencies. Because all-powerful means you have all the power. Now, if you have all the power and there's another thing with all the power, then you've got two things with all the power. How does that work? That contradicts the fact that the first thing has all the power. If this is all over all things capable, how can this one be over all things capable and this one be over all things capable? That must mean one of them is not over all things capable, or both of them are what? Not over all things capable. That's by necessity. Because that's the thing, right? And that's the thing. So if they're both over all things capable, either both not over all things capable, or one of them is over all things capable, and the other one is not. These are the logical possibilities.
Is there like a qualifier here that over all, say, contingent things capable?
You can say that if you want, over all things capable. But well, even if we say all things.
Yeah, with things we're only referring to, because it's just because someone might come and say, okay, what about like square circles?
Okay, great. I get what you're trying to say. Yeah, yeah, so the impossible existences, okay, impossible existences are not things. على كل شيء قدير, like a square circle is not a thing. It's an unintelligible. We would say it's an unintelligible. It's not something which can exist in the real world. The meaning itself only carries grammatical value. Like if you say there is a squared circle, that sentence has only grammatical value, but that sentence does not have any real-world implication. You will not be able to find a squared circle or a squared triangle, because what we mentioned this before, kind of alluded to, is that the things that need to be in place to give a triangle its triangularity cannot be in place at the same time, giving a triangle is triangularity and a circle is circularity. The two things cannot exist at the same time, because in essence, a triangle with its triangularity is differentiated from a circle with circularity. They have different essences, and they cannot coexist. And so the idea of a square triangle, square circle, whatever it is, those two things cannot coexist together in at the same place, at the same time, in the same way. Yeah, and as such, impossible existences are not things. So can God create a rock so heavy that he can't lift? That would suggest that you can have a God that's A, over all things capable, and B, not over all things capable at the same time, which is a squared circle scenario. It's the same thing as saying, can God, who created God? It's like saying what? Who started God, or who began God? It's like saying who created the one who's uncreated, which is the question itself has a presupposition. Not a question cannot be a contradiction, by the way, but it can have a presupposition which is contradictory. So the presupposition of the question is that there is conceivable that there can be something which is created and uncreated at the same time. So when they say, can God lift a rock so heavy that it can't lift? So, to be facetious, like I say, get the rock and you've disproven God. That rock is the evidence of the disproof of God. You know, that rock there. But the idea is, what you're essentially presupposing is that there can be a capable, uncapable God, or a God that is over all things capable, at the same time is not over all things capable, at the same time. And that is an impossible state of affairs. And therefore, it's not a thing. And therefore, it's not a thing that God can be, of all things, powerful of, because it's not even a thing. It's an unintelligible. Likewise, who created God? Which Michael Ruse, when he was attacking Richard Dawkins, because that was one of his main questions in his God delusion, he said, Richard Dawkins screaming around, who created God, like a schoolboy? He's embarrassing the atheists, he said. Because obviously Michael Ruse is an atheist himself. I mean, he's a top-notch atheist philosopher. He said, this is embarrassing. We know the answers to these questions. And these are the answers. They're stock answers that have been there for millennia, not even centuries. And they're there. And so what we're saying is that the question itself has presuppositions. If they say, can God create contradictions? Say, contradictions themselves are unintelligible. You see? That's we exclude from the category of things impossible existences. They're not shape in the first place.
I had a response to this that I liked. You know, someone yeah. asked, you know, can God create a rock so if you can't lift? He's like, it's like if I ask you, like, you know, have you stopped beating your wife or something like that? You know, you're assuming that he has a wife, and you're assuming that. So what do you say, like, if you demand a yes no answer to that question? Either way, you're finished, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Have you stopped beating your wife?
It's like, so if you say yes, then you know you'd admit you used to beat her before.
Yeah.
If you say no, then
there are some questions which are ridiculous. Like if someone says to you, "Okay, what day of the week is it? Yes or no?" Do you not answer my question? Is it yes or no? Is it what day of the week was it? Yes or no? It's a category mistake fallacy. The question itself is problematic, you know. But you have to see, you have to really know where the questions are, where it's like that. If the necessary, so we talked about this. The third argument, the last argument for the day. In order for nature to be stable, uniform, and regular, there must be only one external agent arranging the world. Nature is stable, uniform, and regular, therefore there must be only one external agent arranging the world. Why? This is an argument from, if you like, it's probabilistic, but it's a very strong probabilistic argument, because it's saying, if you have two minds, if you have two wills, and this you can make the argument in a non-probabilistic way, where I say, if you have two wills, two ultimate wills, and both of them are in ultimate control of the world, okay? Then what happens? Then decision making, when we go back to particularization, is not centralized. And as such, we don't expect to see results in nature which indicate centralized decision making. So chaotic order would ensue. This is what the Quran says. You know, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لو كان فيهما آلهة إلا الله لفسدتا. If there were any gods other than Allah, then the universe, heavens and earth, would have been corrupt. Do you know there's another verse? Sorry, I was just thinking about it. There's another verse which is quite similar. Which in Surah Al-Mu'minun, where it says, this is quite an interesting verse. وَلَوَ اتَّبَعَ الْحَقَّ أَهْوَاءَهُمْ لَفَسَدَتِ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَنْ فِيهِنْ. If the truth had followed their desires, then the heavens and the earth would have been destroyed, and whatever is inside of them. Because our desires are volatile. You know, if our desires, which are hedonistic and volatile and unpredictable, were what was in control of the universe would have been corrupt. Because what you require is a will which is intelligent and non-emotional, if you like, in order for nature to be regular, stable, and uniform. So basically the argument here in the Quran is, the fact that nature is uniform, stable, and regular is indicative of a fact that you have a uniform will, an intelligent will, which decides on how the order of the universe should be. And we said already that regularity, stability, and uniformity are not things which you discover by science. They are presuppositions of science. In other words, you must presume uniformity, stability, and regularity before you start the scientific enterprise. Because if you don't, as we said, if we said that water boils at, or it freezes, boils at 100 degrees today, and tomorrow it will boil at 1,000, and after tomorrow it won't even boil at all, or whatever it is, then we can't even do science, because every time we do an investigation under the same conditions, the results will be different. So science would be a fruitless enterprise. And that's what the Quran, you know, alludes to when it says, هَلْ تَرَى مِنْ فُطُورٍ. Do you see any gaps in creation? What kind of gaps? These kinds of gaps. صُنَعَ اللَّهَ الَّذِي أَتْقَنَ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ. This is the construction of God, who He had perfected everything. So what kind of perfection are we talking about? The fact there's no gaps, meaning it's regular, it's stable, it's not unpredictable. There's predictability, and if you don't believe these things, you can't do science. And so, what explains this best? The fact that you have a uniform, centralized will, like as you would expect. And I gave the example before, if I drove a car, and for example, me and my wife drive a car, and we separate from each other, or someone, me and someone else, me and him, drove a car, and we separate from each other, can't see each other. And I have one steering wheel, he has another steering wheel. And maybe four of us, and one guy in the back, and this guy, and all of us have steering wheels. Where's the car going to go? It'll go around itself like a dog, chasing its tail. Especially if we don't have communication with each other, which can't be assumed anyway. Well, you'd have to make a policy. It's now the burden of proof is on the policies to argue how they have communication and now collaboration and how do they make decisions, you know, these four. And in addition, when they make decisions, is there compromise? But if there's compromise, that indicates weakness on the behalf. And then you go back to the first one. If it's all capable, then how can you be weak? You see? Imagine each wheel was being dictated by the steering wheel. Where would the car go? Nowhere. The fact that the universe is moving in one direction, or at least is harmonious, predictable, stable, regular, which is incontrovertible, indubitable fact, and something which cannot be disputed, is undisputed actually, something which you need to do science, is indicative of the fact that you have a centralized decision maker of the universe.
Aircraft, you have two sticks, yeah? And
two?
Joysticks, or you can call it two strings, or whatever you
want. Okay, yeah.
And you are never allowed, there's going to be one person. So if you have two pilots, you decide before the flight who's going to be the one in charge of flying, touching the...
Oh yeah, you do that, don't you? Yeah. Your pilot.
So,
huh?
So have nobody, it. Nobody is. So the other pilot will never touch the joystick or the string until they decide to change. So at all times, it's going to be just one person.
That's right.
And that's one of the reasons that you mentioned.
That's an even better example, I think, than my car example. Let's get some of these polo theists to go in an airplane that's being dictated by four or five different.
that's one like a big rule, like a big rule. Like you can't, you have to decide who's gonna be in charge, who's gonna be the one, and you have to let that person, in a bit of accident or like emergency, you have to decide. You have to let that person do everything. You can't interfere, because if you interfere, you have the problem. You say, well, I might decide to go left, and one might decide to go right.
Yeah. So these are the arguments for oneness of God. We will conclude with that. Thank you very much for listening to our lectures and our sessions. Hopefully you've benefited as much as we have here. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.